Okay, chapter 9, Waging Unseen Warfare. Unseen warfare as opposed to warfare that is waged so that other people can see that we're waging warfare, and so that we ourselves can see that we're waging warfare, and so that our pride, our self-asserting pride and lack of Christian humility are paraded before the world, and we can all feel good and self-righteous about ourselves because we're trying to do something against those people. And fill in the blank with those people. So unseen warfare is not that kind of thing. It's not the culture wars. It's something that takes place inside of us. And it is the principal task of every true Christian. Archbishop Verkey says on the very first page of the chapter 110. And then I want to mention as quickly as possible the people who are allowed to do something outside of themselves. Only those who what? Anybody remember where that is or what it says?
I think it's on the bottom of page 111.
Well, 114 is what I have in mind.
Oh, okay.
Only one who has battled with evil in his own soul can successfully wage battle with evil in general, and therefore the battle with evil must begin in one's own soul with unseen warfare. So, those are the people who are in a position to try to deal with evil outside of themselves. And they will do it with the kind of humility that we find exemplified by Elder and Saint Paisios. And those people are very reluctant to be drawn into conflict. In his case, there I know of only one occasion where that happened, and he was drawn out about his opinion on something and regretted it, and people are still using it. So even if you're very, very careful, and even if you have accomplished this unseen warfare within yourself, and I think there's no one in this table, certainly including me, who is in that kind of position, but even if you have done that, and you have dealt with all of your passions inside of yourself, it's not a matter of repressing them. You can repress them on your own strength and authority. I'm just back Thursday, the gauntlet that I've been through since last Wednesday, that's the time, has included, first of all, a presentation at Tuckahoe Falls College, which was fun but demanding. I have, as I sent the email out, put that talk up online if people want to listen to it. It's not protected by a password. It's in the section called Lectures on our website. But there was that. And reading the chapter that they used in their book about prayer, the chapter devoted to Orthodox prayer, and it seems to me that it's in that book that they talk about repressing passions. If you're repressing passions, you're not dealing with them. It means you're trying to use your own will and strength in order to squash them down. You are relying on yourself. So dealing with these passions, we've just started to look at what it takes. The unseen warfare is what it takes, and the particulars are for the most part yet to come in the following two chapters, the one on Christian struggle and chapter 11, the Holy Fathers on combating the passions. Basically, we have only two more chapters beyond this one. The final one, chapter 12, which is very short, is called Pastoral Asceticism. It's for pastors, priests, bishops. We can look at it if you want. There was one chapter similar to that in Elder Paisios' book, as I recall. But it wasn't so specific in particular because Elder Paisios wasn't a priest. It included pastors, but I don't think it was particular and exclusive to priests. This one is more known, but we could find ourselves in a pastoral situation, so probably we should just go ahead and do that last short chapter as well. At any rate, back on page 112, the relationship of every true Christian to every type of evil, wherever it may appear, is a relationship of complete and unconditional irreconcilability. And we can come up with all kinds of ways of reconciling ourselves to evil in the world or in ourselves. But the only place that we can actually effectively deal with evil is in ourselves. Out in the world are refusal to reconcile ourselves with evil will exclude a self-righteous effort to stand up on the basis of our own strength against evil in the world. Most of the time, when we try to oppose evil in the world, we will find, we're not Elder Paisios, we're not holy men and women, we know that about ourselves. That being the case, how much have we actually got to rely on in our active opposition to evil in the world? 9 times out of 10, we will rely on ourselves, and even though we may feel very good about things that we've decided to stand against in the world, I would be willing to bet that 9 times out of 10, our opposition to evil in the world will come under the heading of reconciling ourselves to evil in the world by taking a position against something and then condemning people who don't take that position. Is that fighting evil? That's the question. I did mention how difficult it is, even for someone who has dealt with evil inside of themselves to a great degree, to have any kind of positive effect or influence in the world out there. But for us to do it, what are the chances that we are not going to reconcile ourselves to evil in the world by choosing a position or an opinion and then pursuing it? That, I would say, comes under the heading of reconciliation with evil. That's the part that's difficult to understand. But I really think that's true. Any discussion on that point? It's kind of a cool point, I think.
What is it saying?
I'm trying really hard not to be proud of it.
I'm not making the connection, Father. I don't know why is that a reconciliation?
Let's choose up sides. Once you get to that point, you have found a way of reconciling yourself to the presence of evil in the world. Because we're going to go out and fight a war because we know our side is the right side. So whatever kind of war it is, if it's a shooting war or if it's some other kind of war in the world, we have chosen a side. There are 2 sides. My side, which is right, and the other side, and they're no good. I call that a reconciliation with evil, because that is exactly what the enemy wants us to do, to divide us in the world against one another, rather than resorting to the peace of Christ. And we know that the only place we can deal with that sort of thing is inside of ourselves. Even saints have a difficulty in dealing with that chaos out in the world. And remember last chapter, Bishop Averke mentioned that if we all dealt with ourselves, we would have peace. So that's what I mean. It's a difficult point because it is understandable at a level just above where we're actually at. So we can get an intellectual understanding of it. It doesn't mean we're going to be able to go out and function like that.
Well, it seems like that wouldn't be our focus.
Absolutely.
We're not created to take a side. I mean, it seems like it would take our focus away from this.
I would say if that, exactly,
loving people
as our primary thing.
Right.
And it is such a great way to encourage us to take our eye off the ball. Because if we're fighting evil out in the world, whatever's going on inside of me, it's left to do whatever it's doing. If that worked, Christ would not have come to destroy evil, sin, suffering, and their power within the person. He would have just chosen a people, backed them, and done an Old Testament scouring of the world. And people who like that sort of thing like to refer to the Old Testament, where the chosen people are out scouring the promised land of all of those bad Philistines and things like that. And they take that model and they apply it to this world and call themselves Christians. I think if that worked, the Old Testament would be much shorter. There wouldn't be so much time spent getting ready for the coming of Christ. And Christ would not have been. There would never have been an incarnation of the Son of God to show us that what we need to do is to deal with sin within ourselves and to use His way of doing it, because nothing else will work. Does that make sense?
I have a question on that.
Okay.
So let's say a person is put into a situation
and, you know, told, let's say, by an employer to do something that you know is a sin. And, I mean, you have to make the choice either out of financial security.
So he's telling you to steal or murder?
Put people's lives at risk.
Or...
And you have to make the choice to either go and do what they say out of your the need for financial security that is so rampant in the world, or go against what you know it could possibly risk people's lives. I mean, in a situation like that.
I've done that sort of thing. It's a kind of protest. It's come up in my course, as a matter of fact, within this last couple of days. I was gone for 2.5 days, and my most difficult students achieved a state of rebellion that is jaw-dropping. They were interested in the idea of rebelling. First of all, it's a kind of civil action. Like if you're a whistleblower or something like that, or when I was working for Rockwell International, and I was expected to write a report about the machine that we made that I knew didn't work, and give it a glowing report and misrepresent the fact that it did not work. I turned in a report that advised the people that we had sold our machine to in England that, and this, of course, I didn't send it directly to them. I sold it to my immediate superior, my manager, who had asked me to write the report. My advice to them was that they sink the machine in the English Channel to use it as a fish reef. But when I did that, I was fully prepared to accept the consequences.
I mean, as long as one.
And I didn't think I was scouring evil from the world. I was just kind of a whistleblower, and I just had put. I was fed up with it, so I did that. But did it improve me inside of myself? No. I mean, it made me more arrogant, more prideful. I had stood my ground, etc., etc. So doesn't it seem as though if we are going to do something in the world of a spiritual nature that makes a positive difference, that it would have to at the same time make a positive difference within ourselves? So, now I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I'm saying it's a political action. It's not necessary, it's not something that we can feel as though, what would Jesus do? He would do that. He didn't. That's not the kind of thing he did. And he had plenty of opportunities. So, yeah, you can decide to do it. And you do it for the sake of, I don't know, a sense of civic responsibility. Fine. But it's not about spiritual life. You're taking a public stand for the sake of your fellow citizens, which is fine, but pretty much a matter of the business of the world. So I would make a distinction between doing that sort of thing and dealing with evil. Because you haven't dealt with evil when you've done that. All you've done is pointed a finger and say, hey, this is not right. It's not the same thing as dealing with evil. Dealing with evil has to be done within ourselves. The person responsible for having done that, they could deal with that evil within themselves. But I can't reach into somebody else's mind or heart or soul and do it. So that's the difference. We're talking about an active waging of unseen warfare and a struggle for virtue. And we can't do that on behalf of other people in some kind of public activist way. It has to be done within ourselves.
That would be waging sin warfare or whatever.
It would be. And Archbishop Averke has mentioned that warfare in the world, and so it's a kind of act of war in a way, even the example that we were talking about, even though we're not talking about shooting anybody, it is a kind of warfare in the world. And Archbishop Averke has said, yes, it is possible. The church has said that sometimes that kind of external warfare is necessary in order to prevent a greater evil. So fine, if that's the case in the example that you're bringing up about an employer trying to get you to do something that's wrong, then maybe this warlike act that's being contemplated, whatever it is, whistleblowing or whatever, maybe it is justified. But there is no dealing with evil going on there. It's just to keep things from getting worse, which people will run with, you know. I mean, you know, as soon as you say that, well, there is this exception, all of a sudden, all kinds of exceptions will come up. Guy, Benjamin.
Oh, it sort of reminds me of St. Paisios. when he was in the army, before he got into the situation, he was praying that he wouldn't have to kill anybody. I think that would be a good start.
Right. There's enough killing going on out there without everyone having to have blood on their hands. There was a role that he played in that war. He didn't wash his hands of it on the grounds that war is wrong. He participated in it, but he was very concerned about the possibility of being forced to take a human life. Would he have done so? Had he been in a position where he had a choice between doing his duty or not doing his duty? If it was his duty to do that?
I think he would have if he were protecting someone else.
And I also think that if he thought that he could work a better outcome, he would definitely sacrifice his own life in order to avoid doing it. On the same grounds of action in the world. Yeah.
He was always in obedience to someone.
That's right.
Abraham and his son.
Abraham. Right. I know he did mention that he volunteered, I think, for some things that could be dangerous. So that he could...
It wasn't out of concern for his own skin.
It was out of concern because of that something could happen to somebody else.
Somebody else who had children.
Children and stuff like that.
Right. I mean, he was obviously very brave in the war. I don't know if he got a medal or not. If he wouldn't have mentioned it.
Seems like somebody else got the medal that he was supposed to get.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. So he was awarded a medal. Somebody else accepted it, and he kept quiet. That is 100% Elder Paisios. That's exactly what we would not surprised to find that he did that. So even the way we pursue warfare in the world, a shooting war or some other kind of confrontation, is different than what we might expect. We never get a blank check to just go out and be the flail of the Lord and wipe out all the people.
It feels so much better to do that because you don't have to worry about looking at the yucky stuff that's inside. I mean, I'm saying this because I know from personal experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's easier to do that. I think Melissa asks a question that is a good question. That is, if something comes to us and we have to make a moral choice, I think we can make the right choice, but we don't have to make a parade about it and make it us against them. Say, oh, I'm sorry, I won't be able to do that. We can humbly not do it and try to sidestep it or some other way do it. But what I'm more tempted to do is say, this is an opportunity for me to glow in my righteousness before others and stand up and say, I could not possibly do this. What Father Jacob said, it's us against them. I'm right, they're wrong. And now I've entered into pride, which is death. And we're not in a spiritual battle there. We are. We're losing it.
Yeah.
But I think that, we can, there's a way to not do things that, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I can help in other ways, or maybe I can't be a part of this concern or whatever it is, but, putting our trust in God, I think we can humbly refuse to do something. But once we start taking up arms and having a battle that puts us in a kind of a self-righteous position, which I've done plenty of time, that's why I know about it, it doesn't end up with leading to peace. I've always been surprised that other people don't just change their minds because I give very articulate arguments about why, my side is better. And people just, obviously aren't looking for the truth or they would come to my side. Just these people here are close enough to me to know that that has not led to any spiritual growth in my life, that sort of thing. There is even, I think,
a possibility of making a distinction. We're outside the text completely here, but between an ethical dilemma and a moral dilemma. Ethics may be about what's going on out there. A moral dilemma may be a conflict between the realm of the inner life, and I don't know if it's that simple, but it's a tempting thing to say. Somebody else was it you, Sharon? I was going to say something. I thought somebody else.
I think that's why we have a priest.
Well, no, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know about that. It's why we have access to confession.
Yes.
Because the priest is a functionary,
not
a resident elder.
Wow.
Absolutely. Thank goodness. Okay, so a Christian's calling, bottom 110, is With what evil should a Christian constantly do battle? Can it be that his calling consists of incessantly observing, watching for the appearance of evil in the people surrounding him, and to judge, rebuke, and punish them for this evil? Obviously not. The majority of people act in just such a way. Each of us, each person, seeks out evil in other people, reproaching, attacking, and berating them, and feeling self-righteous and justified, not noticing the evil in their own soul. And noticing the evil in our own soul, observing, watching for the appearance of evil in our own soul, that is our calling. So with what evil should the Christian engage in battle? This battle with evil should be a battle in his own soul. The battle should begin with oneself. One who has fought and rooted out evil in his own soul will much more easily wage a battle with evil in the souls of other people. And we don't get to say, well, I go to confession, I confess my sins, I'm struggling to be better, and so I get to battle evil in the souls of other people. No, this isn't, this, no. It's a reference, again, to the example that we had before. Only one who has battled with evil in his own soul can successfully wage battle with evil in general. And that would be someone who would obviously appear to us as a saintly and holy person. And then they will be struggling with evil outside of themselves with all of the resources, not their resources, but the resources that they have of Christ's, because of the humility and clarity with which they can see their own sins. That's what gives them the ability to deal with evil out in the world.
I can't think of any way that I could address the evil in someone else other than through prayer.
I would have to agree with that.
I mean, I try to
And also, the prayer that we would want to pray would also not be a prayer, God fix this person because they are really messed up.
Of course not, yes.
That wouldn't be how we would pray. If we prayed like that, then God would not hear that prayer, mm-hmm. because we're letting him know who's naughty and who's nice and what he ought to do about it. You know, and we're not in that position.
Yeah.
So again, we can only deal with ourselves.
Right.
So like prayer for your enemies, that prayer is great. It, you know, anybody who's not familiar with it should look it up. And in that prayer, we thank God for the fact that our enemies have done us better spiritual service than our friends, because they have not let us get away with anything. They've pointed our shortcomings out to us, which helps us spiritually, and we ask God to give us more enemies so that we can make more spiritual progress. This is quite different than asking God to deal with these troublesome people.
But I try to imagine addressing someone face to face or saying something to someone, and I suppose I've tried that. But I don't remember it ever working.
No. I've had people ask me to do it. And on those few occasions when I was silly enough to comply, it didn't work out well. Beginning of the last paragraph to bottom, 111. A battle with evil in my own soul is a true Christian's one true principle. Neither mutual persecution nor oppression for different political convictions, nor the brutal annihilation of dissenting individuals with which modern leaders are occupied, and which these leaders try to enlist Christians on their side for this sort of battle, but the destruction of evil in one's own soul instead is that which is necessary. The ancient ascetics undertook tireless battle with evil in their own souls, and they named this battle unseen warfare. Second paragraph from the bottom, second line in. Unseen warfare, unseen by the external eyes of man. And if we are fortunate enough to run into somebody like Elder Paisios, his eyes will be the eyes who will be able to see the unseen warfare, because he's looking with not external eyes, but with the ability to see into the hearts of others. For this battle is internal and takes place inside of the soul of man. In times past, the principles of this battle were well known to laity, to those living a secular life, as opposed to monks. For this battle is mandatory for all those bearing the name of Christian, without exception, as the guidelines for this battle are laid out in the gospel. Okay. Most of us in America, and there is a turn, it seems to me, in the last few years, but most of us in America who have converted to Orthodoxy, at least it's been the norm, not always, we've converted because of, well, even St. Timothy is a kind of an exception, but I think by and large, converts become Orthodox in America for a very American Christian sort of reason, because they find that the doctrine and teaching appeals to them. And so you have intellectual converts, converts who choose the doctrine and teaching of the Orthodox Church as superior to that of their own upbringing or Western Christianity, and which is entirely rational and reasonable, and certainly Orthodox Christian doctrine and teaching has the fullness of the doctrine and teaching of the Church from the beginning down to our own time. But it's possible to affirm doctrine and teaching and not deal with spiritual life at all. You know, that's possible. And it happens a lot. It happens a lot. What we're talking about here, these are the critical things that need to be done. Okay, page 113. Second paragraph, just below the middle of that paragraph. Visible warfare. Visible warfare has taken the place of unseen warfare in the life of modern man. And as people who want to consider themselves Christians, they much prefer it, for reasons that are probably clear to us by now. This visible warfare is a never-ending back-and-forth battle, taking cover under the glib that's good-sounding but full of baloney. That's what I say glib means, under the glib designation of, quote, battle for survival, which supposedly is the foundation for human existence in our time. So everybody agrees on it at an external level. And it's a matter of surviving in this world as it is, you know. And we Christians, we know how to do that better than other people. So we can tell you how you ought to live and how you should change yourself so that you can prosper. There are churches like that. And the battle with evil being conducted by modern people is not successful for the most part, because people battle not so much with evil as with other people, while at the same time harboring that very same evil in their souls. This is true to an incredible degree. Top of 114. In our world today, in society today, evil is often considered good, and vice versa. There is a confused understanding of good and evil, and with this confused understanding of good and evil, the battle that will make a difference, the battle with true evil, is made more difficult, because you can take these confused standards of society, apply them within yourself, and where do you even begin? And here's the quotation that I jumped down to: only one who has battled with evil in his own soul can successfully wage battle with evil in general. And therefore, the battle with evil must begin in one's own soul with unseen warfare, a continuous inner battle that a Christian wages in order to reach Christian perfection. Now, of course, only the Orthodox would be interested in this. Because as far as the Roman Catholic, at least as far as, you know, I don't want to be unfair, you know, and I will, in my effort to be unfair, I will be less clear, which is unfortunate. But let's say that the real truth of things is that, and we'll just go to the easiest example, the Calvinists. We are damned, we are totally damned. Certain people have been set aside to be saved, but basically we're all totally damned, and even the ones who have been set aside, they deserve to be damned as well, but God has decided that he's going to save them. And we're all totally damned, and we're incapable of cooperating with God in our own salvation. If that's the case, this book goes in the trash. Unseen warfare is obviously impossible. I won't complicate it by saying anything else, but do you see the point? And Augustine, I'm not saying this covers the entire Roman Catholic Church in its 2,000-year history. Their history is as old as ours. In the beginning, it was our history. You know, there was a divergence, but you can't condemn the whole of the West and reduce it to Calvinism, because there's more there than that. Now, the more that's there is inconsistent with this idea that started with Augustine, that we're all damned and we can only be saved by accepting Christ's sacrifice on the cross, and then we won't go to hell after we die. But in the meantime, there is precious little that we can do that doesn't come about as a result of God doing something from outside of us so that we can do something good. We completely reject that. We say, no, that's not true. We can participate in our own salvation, and we can point out places where St. Paul agrees with that and encourages people to fight the good fight, run the race until you die. That race that's being run is the same thing we're talking about here with unseen warfare. The struggle is within ourselves. But the main point is that with this kind of spiritual effort, for the most part, with a few exceptions maybe, it's certainly not the center of life in the Christian West, and I would say is absolutely discounted by the majority of Western Christians as an impossibility.
Go ahead, Ben. I think that that sentence right there, if we're going to take it... That's the humility pill that you were talking about.
Right, yeah, I want that. I want.
I was never really completely comfortable with the tenets of Calvinism, and you know, probably was still looking for the truth when I came across the Orthodox Church and said, oh, that's what I was looking for. You know, and then and so, you know, what I do remember being comforted by someone that was very much a Calvinist. They said, you really can't do anything about it anyway. You know, you're either elected or you're not.
It's determinism.
And, you know, you've done that already. God, it's all under grace. There's nothing you can do about it. It's under the blood. And you just basically said, you know, it's not what we do that makes all that much difference anyway. It's that God has chosen to do this for us. And just something didn't ring quite true about it, because I knew better inside. You know, that I could have done something different than I had done. And I don't even remember what it was, but I knew that wasn't actually the way it was.
Yeah.
He's saying something here that I can see where that idea of Calvin and the idea of
Augustine
comes from.
And Luther, too.
Because as he's saying, it is impossible to rely only upon one's human powers. Essentially, all also is supernatural divine help, the power of God's grace that, as we know, is made perfect in weakness. In other words, you can't do it on your own. You have to accept it through God's grace. And then I can see where that interpretation could be taken a little further and say that we...
God has to do it for me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's impossible.
Right.
And that sounds humble.
A rejection of synergy.
That's right. A rejection of human responsibility. Whereas our understanding is that Christ came in order to make it possible for us to participate in the spiritual effort that he made on behalf of all of us by ascending the cross, dying, destroying death, and opening a pathway for us to do this kind of unseen warfare inside of ourselves. Okay.
There is the peace, though. I think that I know that there's places where I have to say this is something that I need to do that I can't do it. You know, how can I do this? And at a point where I find myself at the end of my ability to, and specifically where this came up for me is dealing with feelings of resentment toward people. And I read the article that that Metropolitan General wrote, do not react, do not resent, keep inner stillness, do not resent. And his point in the article, as I recall, was almost all of our problems in our life have to do with us have a resentment toward other people.
Right.
And I looked at that, and I spent some time writing down. So I thought, is that true? And I found them coming up.
Yeah.
Lots of them. And then, so what do you do with it? Well, forgive. What does that mean? Well, I think, you know, it means we don't try to get them back, for one thing. And then, so what do we do? But I asked God, I just said, God, here I am. I had them on a yellow legal pad. And this is coming to my experiential, what I did. But I wrote them down because I just, they were coming. And I thought, what are all these things? I need to get rid of them. How do I get rid of them?
All right.
So I just kind of wrote them all down. And probably at some point brought some of this to confession in some fashion or the other, but I'm sure this isn't the first time you've heard this story, but I said to God, I don't know how I can forgive for all of these things.
Yeah.
And I asked God, help me to forgive. And nothing special happened at that point. I had to get up and go. Lunch was over. I went back to work. Well, the next time I saw the particular person I was having the struggle with, I didn't feel the resentment. Just the effort that I made, and I don't know what the where the lines are, but we must rely on Christ, in my experience. I mean, we can do things, go in a certain direction, but where's the part where, like Peter going out on the water, I guess. He couldn't walk on water.
My suspicion is that Metropolitan Jonah's advice and guidance there is good advice and guidance to help us get to the point where we can repent and be aware of the things that we ought not to do.
Holding all those resentments.
But we may not have the ability to do it, may not yet be there because of where we're at. And so we can recognize it, we can see it. What do we do about that? Well, yes, okay, we could talk about the struggle. There is an alternative. And that is Elder Porfirio's alternative. I know you've read him, that's why I'm pointing at Theodora. And I do have that quotation with me, because I used it to call falls. There are two paths, Elder Porfirio says, that lead to God. The hard and debilitating path with fierce assaults against evil within us, and the easy path of love. There are many who choose the hard path and shed blood in order to receive spirit until they attain great virtue. I find the shorter and safer route is the path of love. That is, you can make a different kind of effort to study and pray and have your aim to advance in the love of God and of the church. Do not fight to expel darkness from the chamber of your soul. The ego can become involved. That's the secret. Open a tiny aperture, a tiny opening, for the light to enter, and the darkness will disappear. The same holds true for our passions and desires. Do not fight them, but transform them into strengths, Christ's kind of strength. Remember, humility, all that sort of thing. Less self-regard, cutting into self-regard. Do not fight them, but transform them into strengths like Christ's strength by showing disdain for evil. Jimmy made a quotation the other week about it's not so much that evil is so awful as it is that it's a waste of time. Show disdain for it. It's a similar comment. Do not choose negative methods to correct yourselves. Famous abbots of monasteries are always pointing out to monks who are just putting themselves through all kinds of spiritual self-inflicted torture, that these are negative methods that go over the top, and you're being arrogant by thinking that this is going to make a difference. There is no need to fear the devil, hell, or anything else. Elder Paisio certainly did not. These things provoke a negative reaction, and then we're fighting against them on an ego-based level out of fear. Fear of death is 95% of the problem anyway. So we become involved with that. We're going to go round and round in chaos. The object is to live, to study, to pray, and to advance in love. So open a tiny aperture for the light to enter. Now that kind of effort can make a difference after you have realized there's a problem. I am doing these things that Metropolitan Jonah is saying. Don't react, don't respond. What's the other one?
Keep inner stillness.
Keep inner stillness. Okay, you know that's necessary. If you can open this aperture, this whole, in your closed soul, where you're engaged in this struggle that's based on your effort to try to accomplish something that you know you're not going to be able to accomplish, and you ask God to help you, give you the power to do it, and it's still about you having the power to do it. What Elder Porphyrius is suggesting, you're in darkness here. Say the Jesus prayer with the intention being to open your soul, your heart, to God so the light can enter. Because before you are battling in the dark, struggling within yourself on the basis of strength that you didn't have. So when you're up against a wall and you're not able to do this kind of thing, which after all is a kind of spiritual warfare that demands a very high level of humility to even engage in this. So there's something that you can, it's not like, okay, I'm going to do that way, forget about the other. It's the spiritual fathers have a quiver full of alternative things to do. And one of the things that a great spiritual guide, an elder, will do is to look at the particular situation and suggest what he is in a position to recognize has an even chance of working with this person if they follow the advice that's given. So it's very specific and particular. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. And I don't think that Archbishop Averke has made it seem that way in his book either.
I guess what the only thing I was addressing there is it seemed like there was a discussion, do we have the ability or do we rely on Christ for the ability?
Right.
And
we do, and of course we don't.
We don't.
No.
We don't have the ability.
But that doesn't make us Calvinists, that you know that we're unable to do anything. I forget which one of those, total depravity, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Two of your 5 points. But.
Russell Mangiapane was saying to me the other day, you know, you get away from that way of thinking for so long. After being Orthodox for 10 or 15 years, you think about that way of thinking, and you think, they can't possibly think like that. You know, and you just go out, if you go out and check, you'll find out there are people who really do think like that. I mean, we want to be kind to them and say, well, they must just be confused. No, that's the way some people do understand things. And if we've come from that kind of background, it takes a while to get shed of those assumptions about ourselves and the nature of spiritual life. Yes, here I see where Sharon is reading from now, at the last paragraph, 115. It is impossible to rely upon one's human powers. Isn't that it?
Mm-hmm.
The power of God's grace is made perfect in weakness. And that's the critical point. Perfect in weakness, not in total incapacity. We can do things in weakness. We can act in weakness. It would be different to say we cannot act at all. He who desires to be victorious in unseen warfare must establish the following four dispositions or inclinations of his heart. Never in any way rely on yourself. Now, we're talking about spiritual warfare, inner warfare, okay? We're not talking about the founding of Jamestown, you know? He who doesn't work won't eat. Out in the world, you have to rely on yourself to do the things that you are responsible to do. But within yourself, the only one whose effort will make any difference is yours. And you can't rely on yourself to do it. So what can be done can only be done in weakness. If we believe that we can rely on ourselves in this interior warfare, we're not going to get anywhere. There's a difference between what's necessary for us to do in the world, our responsibility in the human community to carry our own weight and do what needs to be done. We need to do that. We can't just sit down and say, well, I'm not going to rely on myself. I'm going to rely on all you people because I don't want to be too forward. That would be a cop-out. That would be distorting teaching about spiritual effort. If that's your attitude out in the world, you have a lot of work to do inside of yourself.
I read it from, and took the meaning that never rely on yourself to say something like, in spiritual efforts, if you rely on yourself, you can often be confused easily by the devil.
Right.
In other words, you can think you're doing something good and well, and you're making progress, etc., etc. So, and you're relying on yourself and not going to your spiritual God or your confessor or something, or even to your fellow people who are struggling.
It's the way the enemy tricked Eve.
Mm-hmm.
She thought she was doing a good thing. The problem was she was acting on the basis of her own ability to choose, and she was relying on herself, and he was encouraging her. God will like this. Rely on yourself and do this thing. I see the similarity between what you just said and what was offered to Eve. I don't know that I'm not making it clear necessarily, but can you see the similarity?
Yeah.
Okay, well, explain it to me then. How are they similar? How is what you said, what happened, what was done to Eve to tempt her? So we're tempted to rely on ourselves. I think that clarifies it. He tempted her to rely on herself,
right,
spiritually, to become like God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mistake we're making when we rely on ourselves inwardly. Same mistake. And as soon as we have a temptation to do that, the enemy will be right there telling, yeah, that's what you're doing. God will love this. You're going to make spiritual progress now. That's the temptation. Always have in your heart complete, resolute hope in the one God, not in yourself. Third, work unceasingly. And fourth, always be in prayer. Well, easy enough to do, right? Constant prayer. Never rely on yourself. These are not things that we can just decide to do and do them. Just like the advice that Metropolitan Jonah gave. It's not like we can read that and say, okay, now I know what to do. I won't ever react or resent. You know about it. You know about it. That's good. That's a teaching. We know about these four things. It's important to know about them. He says, establish the following four dispositions or inclinations. This is going to take a while. This will take the rest of your life, Elder Paisios would say. And you will never be able to give up the effort to do this, because it's something that needs to be actively done, even though it may not sound like that when we first hear it. You have to keep the awareness that this is the way things are. Establish stillness. It's not an overnight kind of thing, but it has to do with humility. It has to do with faith, not in yourself, but in Christ. And not just in his divinity, but in the fact that his humanity is a humanity that we are meant to be like that. We are meant to be like him. If we are human beings, we are meant to be like the humanity of Christ. That's how we go about being like God, because we're human beings. If that were not the case, then we wouldn't be able to do it. The only reason we could do it is because we're created as human beings. And this is our part, to be able to do this.
How would you describe the degree of responsibility we have to this?
It's total. It's absolute. It's 100%. It's not 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to force me to try to explain why that's the case, or is that enough? Our human responsibility as a human being is 100%. We have the responsibility to be human beings who are created in the image and likeness of God. Now, doing that involves humility, all the rest of those things that we don't usually associate with what it means to be a human being, but it is what it means to be a human being in relationship to God. And that responsibility is not half God's and half ours, it's ours.
Christ's commandment is to be perfect, even as his Father in heaven is perfect.
There's a very mysterious saying. There's a lot to it. Archbishop Averke comes to it at one point. In fact, he comes to it, I think, probably very soon, about being perfect. And there's a kind of a contrast, maybe before he gets to it. Let's see. Where does he talk about the high calling of perfection? First, he talks about, well, top of 116. From these things it is clear why there can be no question of encountering unseen warfare among contemporary people who are imbued, filled up, and committed to self-assertive pride. It's either pride or this alternative, which is opposite. For them, pride is more precious than anything else. It is their idol that must be served and worshipped in the place of the true God. Presumptuousness, you know, everybody familiar with the presumptuousness is assuming an authority and right, or whatever you want to call it, that we don't have. You know, presuming to be higher than we are. You know, presumptuousness and confidence in their own power is their principal trait. And they are not able to rely on God because they pridefully reject him and do not desire to know him. And I can hear Jesus saying this, following the one that you are truly like, who is the devil, you know, because that's how he is. Why is it necessary to never rely on yourself in anything? Let us examine this more in depth. Next paragraph, four lines down is where I'm at. From the time of the fall into sin of our ancestors, we, despite the obvious weakening of our spiritual and moral power, generally think very highly of ourselves. We continue to believe that we are something important. We want to sacrifice other people to us because we're important. This spiritual weakness of ours is the primary offspring of self-assertive human pride or self-centeredness. How can grace given for enlightenment and help enter into such a person? If it's already full, you can't pour any more in. It has to empty itself. Someone who thinks that he is something great. God desires to see our sincere recognition of our own insignificance. And the more we can realize our insignificance with respect to God or others who are created in his image and likeness, the more that opening, that little opening that Elder Porfirios is talking about is going to open up. And the light will come in. I would make that connection. The Holy Fathers, last new paragraph, the Holy Fathers indicate the following four dispositions for this purpose. And this isn't a recipe, first add eggs, then put in the flour. It's dispositions that become our goal. Our goal, I probably shouldn't refer back again to Laban in the desert, but there is this great distinction in Laban in the desert between our goal and our end, the end of of everything. We have specific spiritual goals that we work toward, but it's not for their own sake. It's because if we make these our goals, we will be able in the end to enter into the kingdom of God and the peace of Christ and be like him. We want the specifics, the goals, to keep in view. Not things that we can just go ahead and do, but goals to keep in view. There are these four dispositions. Try to perceive your weakness, basing your observations on all your life experiences. I'm going to just read the first sentence of each one of these four so we can get them in order. Number two, top of next page, 118. Ask God in prayer that he gives you the realization of your weakness and insignificance. But first, establish in yourself the conviction that you do not have this awareness and that it can only be acquired as God's gift. Now, there's something we can pray for. God, help me to realize my insignificance, because I do not realize my insignificance. And I need to be aware of this fact, and that can only be God's gift. We are not going to be able to work our way up to realizing that we are insignificant, because everything that we do is going to convince us that we're significant. So that's 100% something that we can't do.
Yeah.
Number three, always fear for yourself and be wary of the crafty designs of Satan, with whom it is impossible to grapple without God's help. Number four, if you happen to fall into some kind of sin, immediately recognize your weakness and complete helplessness. One of the difficulties here is that with many sins, the first thing that we feel is strength and power, because committing sin emboldens our ego. It emboldens our sense of self-reliance. It emboldens a sense of strength and ability to act that we want more than anything else. And so when we commit sin, we can have that. The consequences come and they're disastrous. But still, the high of sin for the ego is like a drug. If you happen to fall into some kind of sin, immediately recognize your weakness and complete helplessness. Not as a self-pitying emotional response, but more soberly. Sober recognition of this will help. Self-pity will only give a salve to the ego. God allowed this fall so that you would know better your own feebleness and insignificance before God. These monastic expressions get to be so difficult that we can hardly hear them. I intended to just to stop before I said insignificance before God, because most of us, all of us maybe here, are not ready to hear that. So it would be better to stop like this. Impress upon yourself that God allowed this fall so that you would know better your feebleness. Stop. Maybe at some point in the future, we'll be able to hear the rest of it. But right now, it's difficult to hear. It's like one of those difficult things to hear that we mentioned last week. Somebody wanted to say something.
On number four, I would think that if we realize God allowed that fall, that we would also thank him if we first prayed to realize our insignificance.
Right.
So we'd actually thank him for the experience.
That makes sense to me.
For it,
right.
In a sense.
When it happens, we're liable to rebel against it. So we have to keep an eye on us rather than be thankful. These things, of course, work together.
It's simple.
Yeah. They're not four separate things, really. They're four things that we know about all four of them, and we see where each one comes in when we're dealing with some specific temptation or fall.
It seems even if you try to do one or two of those without doing the other two, you can really get out of balance.
Yeah, there's always a way of reinterpreting things so that we don't do what's being suggested. Humility is the only way we can keep all these things in our understanding without rejecting them. Okay, I'm going to fold the page over, and we'll start next time on the middle of 118 and finish it out. Christian struggle is fairly short, so it may be that the rest of this chapter, Christian struggle, would be good for next week. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lifetime of work right in that one chapter.
Absolutely. Oh,
thank
absolutely.
You, Gary.
That's it. That's the whole.
Gary?
Well, he just described unseen warfare in just a few pages, so.